From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Shaq attack has moved to the Valley of the Suns, but will O'Neal be able to keep up with the frenetic play in Phoenix? We'll get the scoop from FoxSports.com's Kevin Hench. Also, Butler University shines as a major mid-major basketball team, and just who is brave enough to take on the Chinese at table tennis in Beijing? Also ahead, the best reason to put on a funny hat and join a race through the woods.
It's beautiful, and it's full of fresh deer tracks, and there's fresh snow, and it's just beautiful in the woods. It's too bad we have to try to hurry through it.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Some trades are big because one team accomplishes a steal, and others may seem big because of how the fans may feel. But all those who love basketball will understand the deal that's bigger than the rest of them involved Shaquille O'Neal. Isn't that awful? Anyway, that, of course, is because Shaquille O'Neal is very big. Joining me now to discuss the impact, get it, of O'Neal's arrival in Phoenix to join the Suns is Kevin Hench of FoxSports.com. Kevin, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be here, Bill.
The Phoenix Suns aspire to score in 7 seconds or less on every possession. Newly acquired center Shaquille O'Neal barely makes it across center court in 7 seconds these days. Are the Suns and the big Aristotle as poor a fit as it seems on the surface?
Well, I think so. You know, they were my pick to win the Western Conference. And actually, it's odd, but having acquired Shaquille O'Neal, I actually like them less now to win the Western Conference. I think it's a terrible fit for a few reasons. One, I think the Suns' biggest deficiency has been defense, and I don't think Shaquille O'Neal's a good defender at this point. Amari Stoudemire's not a good defender, so you got these two guys defending the low block, one who's young and athletic but has bad defensive instincts, and one who's old and heavy and broken down and has hip and knee injuries. I don't see them being any better defensively. And they lost a guy who could guard point guards to centers, 1 through 5, Sean Marion, and he used to get a lot of tips and deflections for them and start a lot of fast breaks for them and finish a lot of fast breaks for them. I think they're really going to miss Sean Marion. He was underappreciated in Phoenix, and I don't think the big broken-down Aristotle is going to help that team at all. And, you know, Steve Kerr making this deal really mortgaged the team's near future for what I think is a negligible blip of improving their chances to win the title this year. Shaq's got $40 million over the next 2 years left on his contract. I just think it was a disastrous, panicky move for a team that didn't need to panic.
After another first-round playoff exit with a supporting cast of youngsters and journeymen, Los Angeles Lakers superstar Kobe Bryant wanted out. But with this year's emergence of young center Andrew Bynum and the latest addition of forward Pau Gasol from the Memphis Grizzlies, suddenly the Lakers are among the best in the West. Do you think Kobe will be asking for a trade again anytime soon?
No, and I think he's very happy that he's not playing in Chicago right now. I don't know, this worked out dreamily for Kobe because they are definitely the co-favorite to win the West now. I don't think Pau Gasol is a great player, but I think he's a very good player, and he takes just enough pressure off Kobe offensively to allow Kobe to do. I mean, you know, Kobe has kind of become this iconically selfish player over the years, but I think in truth he's very competitive, he wants to win, and he's just as happy getting 8 or 9, 10 assists a game and scoring 25 as opposed to having to take 50 shots and score 45. And I think Gasol will really free him up to be a better all-around player, and when Bynum comes back, their front line is going to be 7-foot Andrew Bynum, 7-foot Pau Gasol, and 6'10 Lamar Odom, and that's going to make a big difference in the playoffs.
Staying in the West for a minute, the New Orleans Hornets and the Dallas Mavericks are atop the Southwest Division. The Hornets have one of the best records in the NBA, but they're 29th in attendance. If you win a division title and no one is there to see it, does it still count?
I feel so bad for New Orleans. I know they have the All-Star game coming up. I don't know. I mean, I think they're a team that's played over their heads a little bit. They strike me as a team that will probably lose in the first round of the brutal Western Conference playoffs. Chris Paul and David West, both all-stars, both deserving all-stars. but I feel like they don't have the depth to compete with these other teams, these who are all improving, by the way, day by day. And I think the Dallas Mavericks may yet surprise with another move before the trade deadline.
In the Eastern Conference, the Boston Celtics still own the best record, but instead of being on a pace to win 75 games this year, they're going to probably have to settle for about 66. Maybe they should just pack it in before they embarrass themselves any further.
Right. I mean, if you're not going to challenge the Bulls' record of 72 wins, why carry on? You know, I picked the Celtics to represent the Eastern Conference in the finals, and I feel better about that pick now than I did 2 weeks ago, because since Kevin Garnett's abdominal injury, we've seen some guys emerging off the bench. You know, the Celtics, the knock on them early in the season was that there was nothing beyond the big three. But now as the season's gone on, we've seen James Posey and Eddie House have been consistent contributors off the bench. Now, Tony Allen, Glenn Big Baby Davis, and Leon Poe are all making significant contributions off the bench. And you have to remember, these guys were blue chippers coming out of college. They've been kind of forgotten, kind of underappreciated on the Celtics bench. And now I think the Celtics go 10 deep, which is something Detroit and Cleveland can't do. And I think that the Celtics will definitely be in the NBA Finals, and we could have a Celtics-Lakers final.
The 2008 All-Star Game, which you mentioned a few minutes ago, will be in New Orleans next weekend. The 2007 All-Star Game in Las Vegas was marked by bad behavior by fans off the court. How's it going to go in New Orleans?
Well, I think the NBA will be prepared this year. You know, I think the league left it up to Vegas last year and sort of was caught by surprise by the near riot that took place. I think New Orleans, you know, having gone through what it's gone through, will be hyper-vigilant to make sure they have a good experience there. As you mentioned earlier, I think it's really too bad that it doesn't seem to be a good city for basketball because they have an excellent team and people don't come out to watch it. So it'll be interesting to see if the All-Star game, I mean, it'll be sold out, obviously, but to see if it's a great experience for the city and proves that they should have a basketball team there. You know, not every city necessarily needs to have a basketball team, as the people of Seattle are learning.
Kevin Hench covers the NBA for FoxSports.com. Kevin, thanks again for joining me.
Thank you, Bill.
The Butler University basketball team is a mid-major that started the season unranked, but the Bulldogs have gone 20-2, taking down traditional powerhouses like the University of Maryland and Ohio State along the way. While it may seem this team has jumped into the national spotlight from relative obscurity, the Bulldogs' successful season represents a growing trend for teams across the country. From Indianapolis, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Mary Ann Holland has our report.
It's just before 2 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, and fans stream into one of the oldest basketball stadiums in the country. Hinkle Fieldhouse is a National Historic Landmark and home of the Milan High School championship win made famous in the movie Hoosiers. But it's actually the home court for Butler University basketball. On this day, fans pack the stadium to watch their home team, one that's garnered the attention of basketball fans across the country. The recent notoriety of the Butler Bulldogs comes after decades of relative obscurity. The men's team hasn't seen an NCAA championship since 1929. But a recent comeback has brought two Sweet 16 showings. Butler's style of play, which relies on team skills, hasn't gone unnoticed by locals and sports fans across the nation. Jim Holmes, a retired toolmaker from Indianapolis, says team play and what he calls good old-fashioned sportsmanship keeps him coming 30 years after he first watched Butler.
They play together, respect one another, respect the other team. That's the reason I like to back them, because they never do anything that you have to be ashamed of, on or off the court.
But David Woods, a sports reporter for the Indianapolis Star, says Butler's talent, more than its sportsmanship, makes its success possible.
I think one of the biggest myths around the Butler basketball program for the last decade is that they're just winning because they're play together and they're a nice group of, you know, nice, fuzzy, warm Bulldogs. But what Butler's been able to do is always find, or usually find, a very good blend of players or blend of skills. So the whole is usually greater than the sum of the parts. But having said that, the parts have been pretty good.
Those parts include five starting seniors. Guards A.J. Graves and Mike Green both got the Sweet 16 rush last year. It's an advantage other teams notice. Butler alum and former Bulldogs coach Thad Matta is now head coach at Ohio State, which lost to Butler in December. Matta says mid-major teams like Butler have benefited from the nationwide abundance of basketball talent.
You're finding it everywhere from, let's say, a George Mason in the ACC country or, you know, Gonzaga in the Pac-10 country. What it says is just how many great players are out there nowadays.
But it's not just about the players Butler recruits. It's also their coaches. From now athletic director Barry Collier to Matta to Todd Licklider, now the head coach at the University of Iowa, to current head coach Brad Stevens, all have worked their way up from within the coaching staff at Butler. In fact, says Woods, all but Stevens are Butler alumni. Stevens says that helps when it comes to interaction with players.
There are obstacles to coaching every day, and there's obstacles to coaching each person because you can't coach them all the same. But I do think that it's been helpful in a lot of ways. You know, I'm not too far removed from playing, and I've been with these guys for, you know, I've been here for 7 years as an assistant, so I was involved in the recruiting process and or have already coached every player on our team. So it's been a pretty seamless transition.
Despite concerns about his age, Butler senior guard A.J. Graves says Stevens, who's just 31 years old, has been a tremendous asset.
It's a lot easier to take advice from somebody that you know has been through it. And sometimes when you have a coach that's, you know, 50, 60 years old, it's hard to imagine them playing basketball or growing up playing basketball. You've seen them that way their whole life. But when you have a 30-year-old coach, you know, you just realize that 6 years ago he was playing basketball, you know, and so it's something you can use as a personal bond.
However far the team advances this season, Stevens' greatest coaching challenges lie ahead. With five starting seniors gone at the end of this year, he'll have no scholarship seniors to replace them. But the coach says for now, he and the players are focused on this year and enjoying a piece of the national spotlight.
Whatever attention we get, we want it to be positive. And we tell our guys all the time, you can't necessarily say that the ball is always going to go in the basket, but you can handle how you conduct yourself. You can control how you play the game. You can control what you do off the court. There's a direct correlation between taking care of business everywhere else and then your success on the court.
The Butler Bulldogs are in Wisconsin today to take on the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay Phoenix. The Horizon League tournament begins March 4th. For Only a Game, I'm Marianne Holland in Indianapolis.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Though she has already won two Olympic gold medals in judo, Japan's Ryoko Tani is not taking that third medal for granted. In preparation for the Beijing Olympics, Tani has said she will spend 3 days listening to lectures by brain specialists in Paris. Media in Japan have referred to the tactic as Tani's brain revolution, and the judo champion has acknowledged that she has been interested in the idea of a neurological approach to training for years. Ryoko Tani became a mother for the first time in 2005, which perhaps explains why she's decided that now she needs brain work. Parents of toddlers the world over will understand.
Beautiful, I've sunshine enough to spread. It's just like the fella said. Tell me quick, ain't love a kick in the head.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the story of one of boxing's more resilient competitors. But first, with just under 6 months before the flame is lit at the Summer Olympics in Beijing, construction is on schedule. Beijing's residents have been reminded to watch their manners, and scientists are even working on plans to make sure it does not rain during the opening ceremonies. But one thing China does not need to worry about is the readiness of its table tennis team, whose members have been focused on training for decades. On the other hand, one of the athletes shortlisted to represent the U.S. is a full-time medical student and part-time pro who's already a world champion but has never been on an Olympic team.
My name is Eric Owens. I'm 32 years old and I live in Chicago, Illinois. In America, it seems to be more like a basement game. It's not even considered a sport. You're playing in your basement, you're playing at the YMCA, you're wearing long pants, you don't sweat, you don't have to lift weights, you don't train. You know, people are always asking me, well, how do you train for ping pong? Like, what do you do? You know, do you sweat? People in America have no idea. I've played a lot of different sports, and to me, table tennis has been the hardest sport out of any of them that I've ever played, because it's physically demanding, it's mentally demanding, and there's so many variables with the speed and the spin. You know, I don't really know of many sports that it takes 20 years of training to become world champion, and that's what it takes. You never ever see a player that's been playing for 5 years and is world champion, or 10 years. Never. It's never been done. It's a lot more physically demanding than people think. Watch the way these guys are moving. You know, look at the power and the explosiveness that they're exhibiting. If you get a little more in tune and a little more experience watching, try to look for the spin, because the spin is really amazing to see how much spin the players are putting on the ball and how little spin they're putting on the ball and making it look like heavy spin, because there's a lot of deception in table tennis. My dad was a player, fell in love with the game in his mid-30s or so, traveled all over the world watching players, and I guess he figured if he ever had a son, that he would live vicariously through the son, which is what he's done, because as soon as I was tall enough to see over the table, I was playing. Coaches from a young age, I was traveling all over the country at the age of 6. I went to Sweden when I was 9 just to watch the world championships. My dad was really strict, very, very hard on me. You know, since day one, he treated it like I would be a professional at some point. I've been to China many times for training. There's no comparison between the U.S. team and the Chinese team. I mean, they're so far beyond our capabilities. Any kid that wants to play table tennis and has talent can develop and be nurtured and embraced by coaches. And we don't have any of that in America. We have 7,000 registered players, and from what I hear, China has 2 million registered players. Can't compete with that. Out of the 7,000 players in America, 90% of them seem like they're 40 years old. There's less than 10 people that make a living at table tennis in the country. Whereas in China, probably thousands making a living. I mean, they fill stadiums. Yeah, even though I'm in medical school, I still make my money from table tennis. It's, you know, one reason why I play. You know, I mean, I do love the sport, but it pays the bills as well, so got to keep doing it.
In April, Eric Owens will compete for one of three Olympic berths at the North American Trials in Vancouver. Our story was put together by Peter Crimmins, a freelance producer based in Philadelphia. Irish Thunder, subtitled The Hard Life and Times of Mickey Ward, tells the story of a boxer remarkable for his resilience and his longevity. According to Ward himself, he started boxing when he was 7. He was still at it 30 years later. Bob Halloran wrote Irish Thunder. He joins me now in the studio. Bob, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
What drew you to Mickey Ward's story?
I was told by a literary agent that everybody was looking for the next Friday Night Lights, and I can't actually move to Odessa, Texas, or someplace like that. So then I thought about New England boxing, and Mickey's name popped into my head. I did some quick research, because you need more than just a story of a boxer. And it didn't take long before I learned about his brother, Dickie Eklund, who was a boxer who fought Sugar Ray Leonard 10 rounds at the Heinz Auditorium back in 1978. And then he fell into crack cocaine, served 4.5 years in jail for armed robbery and kidnapping. And I said, okay, well, here's a story of two brothers and the family and boxing and things like that. So started to ask questions, and something developed.
You bring up Dickie Eklund, Mickey Ward's older brother, certainly one of Mickey's most enthusiastic supporters, but is it fair to say he was also a substantial obstacle to Ward's career?
Yeah, and it was one of my favorite parts about writing the book, is that in sports television that I do for a living, I don't get to be a journalist as much as I'd like. I don't get to ask questions and probe. I'm not a beat reporter, things like that. So this was fun to ask Mickey, you know, what do you think about your brother and his influence on your career? Was it good or bad? And, oh, he was great for me. He was good. You know, he's a good trainer, and he knew boxing and stuff, and he was always there for me. And then as we developed a little bit rapport and some trust, I think he finally told me what he really believed about that. I don't have any specific details of Dickie being messed up on drugs or something when he was in the corner, but Mickey did say there were times when he couldn't understand what Dickie was saying. So I think there's at least a chance that Dickie showed up a couple of times inebriated or along those lines. But he was a good trainer. He did push Mickey. He does know boxing. He understands defense. I enjoyed watching the 30 or so fights that I was able to purchase on DVD with Dickie in the corner frequently, and you can hear what he has to say. And he was definitely, you know, I think a good corner man. In some ways, he was good for Mickey's career, but in other ways, he'd have been much better off with somebody else.
Mickey Ward retired from boxing in 1991 without particularly distinguishing himself as anything other than a tough guy, and then he came out of retirement 3 years later. What did that decision mean to his community, Lowell, Massachusetts?
I think it was, Lowell is very, very proud of its boxing heritage and its boxers. There's an awful lot. I tried to get into that in the book just a little bit because nobody really came out of Lowell as a tremendous champion. There were a lot of New England champions at different weight classes, but not world champions and not boxers of national or international renown. And so Mickey looked like he was the best shot. Dickie looked like it for a while. When he fought Sugar Ray Leonard, that was a big event for the people in Lowell, and they sent busloads of people to all the different fights that Dickie would have or Mickey would have in Atlantic City, for instance. And so when he retired, I feel like Lowell was disappointed and depressed. When he came back, everybody was ready to come back with him, everybody meaning the boxing community of Lowell.
You say at one point, and I guess it's sort of speculation, he was the best thing to happen to Lowell since, well, maybe forever.
Right.
And I'm sure there's some Jack Kerouac fans out there who are shaking their heads, and maybe even an Ed McMahon fan or two, you know, who's saying,
yeah.
Hey, wait a minute.
Or Michael Chiklis, you know. So,
That's right. Yeah,
I think that Lowell, it was interesting to learn a little bit about it and how it was, you know, during the Industrial Revolution, it was one of the high watermarks of America. And Jack Kerouac, of course, being able to paint that picture frequently in some of his books. But I think for a period of time there when Lowell kind of fell into drugs, prostitutions, gangs, things like that, it had a lot of problems through the 80s and into the 90s. And Mickey was rising as the city was falling. And then he retired. And I like the way, at least I tried to show that the parallel between the city making its comeback and Mickey making his.
You write of Mickey Ward that, quote, somehow he walked through the middle of the underworld of Lowell and rose above it. But this is a guy whose corner men, including his brother, were in and out of prison. His father was in and out of prison. One of the guys promoting his fights promoted it from prison, which
right.
I found kind of amazing.
Yep.
How did he rise above that?
I don't know where Mickey gets his moral center. I really don't. It's not in his family. No offense to his family. It's not in the boxing community where there's so much, corruption and things like that. I don't think he's naive. I think he knows what goes on around him. One of the greatest things I can say about him is that he is just so focused on success and hard work. He'll just do the work. You guys can, you know, do your business on the outside. You can steal the money. You can do whatever you want. I'm just working. I'm in the gym. And when it comes to the fight night, I'm going to be in the ring with that guy, and I'm going to do what I do. And I think he lets the chips fall to the side.
At the beginning of his comeback, part of Mickey Ward's ambition was to be a world champion. Mm-hmm. Nothing unusual in that, of course. He does win something called the WBU Championship, which you categorize as fourth on the list of five light heavyweight titles. Mm-hmm. Did the distinction world champion have any meaning in this context?
You know, to him and to those around him, it did, because it provided a belt. He was a guy who finished with 13 losses in his career. The three most famous fights he's had were against Arturo Gatti, and he lost two of them. So he loses plenty. He's just a hard-working, blue-collar, well-respected boxer, and to have any type of championship to his name, I think he's very proud of that.
Mickey Ward's most memorable fights came against Arturo Gatti at the end of Ward's career, as you mentioned. What did Ward earn from those fights in terms of money and, perhaps more important, in terms of reputation?
I think reputation, number one, is that he was known in smaller circles. You know, you had to be a real big boxing fan to know who Mickey Ward was. He fought on ESPN, I think, 23 times, but he really hadn't gotten international exposure or big-time exposure until the last five fights of his career or so when he started fighting on HBO. And so those fights were on HBO. They got him more recognition than ever before. Now, in the first fight, if I remember correctly, he made about $500,000. Then for the second fight, he demanded, I want $1 million. And after everybody takes their cut. And so he ended up with $1 million for that. And the last fight was probably around $750,000. So in his last five fights or thereabouts, I think he was pretty close to $3 million.
And he's held on to a fair chunk of that, you say. He's got a tanning salon. He's training some other fighters. He's making it work.
He lives so humbly. I mean, I talk about in the book that Lowell was not the greatest place for him to grow up at that time. It's a much better city now. But the house he bought after he fought Shane Neary and made about $350,000 for that fight, he came home and bought a house about two blocks away from where he grew up. It's a small home, nothing fancy or anything. He says he carries a mortgage. I can't imagine it's very much, though, because at the time he bought it, you know, just throwing out numbers, I'm guessing it's less than 150 grand. He's got four dogs, a wife and a daughter, and lives very simply with his tanning salon. The one extravagant thing he bought, I remember, was something like a $50,000 Corvette. But other than that, he drives a truck.
Following Mickey Ward's retirement, Dickie Eklund, his brother, who had been in his corner for a period of time and had gotten himself straightened out for a period of years, returned to drugs and crime. He's been arrested since Ward's retirement. Mickey's family doesn't sound like it's changed very much. On the near the last page of the book, you talk about one of seven sisters, any one of seven sisters coming into a locker room drunk before a fight.
Very much so, yep.
Mickey himself, you write about him as if he has a pretty serious alcohol problem. On one night when he gets a car as an award, he's too drunk to drive it home. Somebody
right.
else has to drive him home. It's hard to imagine that it all ends up changing very much.
It's part of a lifestyle that I'm confused by. I don't understand how Mickey can drink as significantly as he did at times during his career and then shut it down and start working hard and getting in shape. The guy is always like 143 pounds of solid muscle. He continues to work out like that. So somehow he's a freak of nature, both in terms of his body, but also his mind is able to do those things. But yeah, the family, I don't think has changed much. Unfortunately for Dickie, I don't think he's changed enough. He has talked the talk, and at times I think he's walked the walk, but more recently he found himself in trouble again with a crack pipe and some residue and was arrested, and so you don't really know where that's going.
Bob Halloran is the author of Irish Thunder, The Hard Life and Times of Mickey Ward, published by the Lions Press. Bob, thanks very much for coming in. It's been
Thank
a pleasure.
Thank you very much. I enjoy it.
You're listening to Only a Game. So a guy here at the station tells me about a florist he knows in the Jamaica Plain section of Boston, and he says she tells him that the UPS delivery guy for her shop tells her about this bet he made concerning the Super Bowl. It seems that before the football season starts, this UPS guy goes to Las Vegas and puts down $500 on the proposition that the New England Patriots will win 19 games and lose none. Maybe you can see where this is going, since to go 19-0 and not just 18-0, the Patriots have to win the Super Bowl. And I think I see where it's going when I'm hearing the story, too, but as it turns out, I don't. So on the day of the Super Bowl, the UPS guy gets a call from the Vegas guy who booked the bet, and he says, "Kid, if you win, you make $2.5 million for your 500. But of course, if the Pats lose to the Giants, you get nothing. So how do you like $1 million right now, which is no little and quite some, and you're up $1 million and no risk tonight?" And here's where you get a notion of what kind of story you like, right? Because some very wrong guys like it if the UPS guy lets his money ride on the Pats. But that's not what he does. He pauses for as long as it takes him to say to himself $1 million, and then he says to the bookie, "I'll take $1 million. And then he only regrets it a little bit that he can't hear the end of the Super Bowl because he is laughing quite loudly and without pausing. In fact, he laughs so loudly that his wife thinks he is crazy, but she doesn't call the cops, which is a good thing because otherwise maybe he is not back home in time for Valentine's Day, which is when he plans to tell her about the bet he made in Las Vegas about 6 months ago. And he thinks this will make for a very happy Valentine's Day indeed. So the guy at the station gives me the name of the florist, and I call her, and she calls me back and says it wasn't actually the UPS guy, but a guy the UPS guy met on a plane, and maybe he knows how to reach the guy, except the UPS guy is on vacation, and nobody knows where he is. So I'm hearing all this from a guy who gets it from a florist whose UPS guy told her about this guy he met on a plane, and maybe it's one of those stories that's so good you just want it to be true. Or at least I do. Or maybe next week I get a call and I find out it is. I'm just a humble radio host, born in the days when enraptured families sat together before the softly glowing Philco set. Your modern world of streaming media and MP3s frightens and confuses me, but that doesn't mean you have to feel the same way. To access podcasts of Only a Game, please go to onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Charles River Apparel, introducing Charles River Sport, a new line of wicking polos and tees in a variety of team colors, charlesriverapparel.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
There is no joy in Ripon, North Yorkshire. The pancake bell will not ring. The traditional pancake race run on Shrove Tuesday was canceled this year. "There are a number of reasons it won't take place," said the very Reverend Keith Jukes, the new dean of Ripon. "A big reason is health and safety. The cobblestone course over which the racers have carried their pancakes seems to be the issue. It can get slippery." This conclusion dismayed pancake race organizer Councillor Bernard Bateman, who said, "Health and safety have just gone too far." That's probably not exactly what he meant. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the contemporary sport of primitive biathlon. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Sunday's game drew more television viewers than any of its predecessors. 97.5 million people watched all or part of the Super Bowl. 81% of the TV sets in the Boston area were tuned to the game. Yours included, I assume.
What? Super Bowl? Who? What?
Wait a minute. You said it was good last week.
What? What? Football game? It's not this week. What? Who?
Moving right along, several of the 97.5 million Americans watching the game emailed Only a Game when it was over. One wants to know if you now think the Giants are the greatest team ever, and the other wants to hear you eat crow. I think that would make a crackling sound if the wings are still in it, because I suppose he's referring to the time that you said the Super Bowl is good.
It is good. It was good. My prediction, on the other hand, was rancid and incorrect.
Sunday's result did not please Nevada's bookmakers. They haven't lost money on a Super Bowl since 1995, so I guess they were figuring the game the same way you and I were.
You know what, though? With the kind of guerrilla math they use, They won't even know that.
Not to worry. Come
NCAA tournament time, they won't even remember how much money they lost.
In the insult to injury department, the National Football League will apparently talk to former New England Patriots video assistant Matt Walsh about whether the Pats taped the St. Louis Rams before Super Bowl XXXVI, which was something like 6 years ago. Isn't there a statute of limitations on this sort of thing?
I think it was V11 years ago, wasn't it?
Something like that.
No, this thing is now because it's being poked and prodded along by the secular political powers and not the religion that is the NFL. This story is going to keep going for a while.
Roger Clemens, who says that he never used steroids or human growth hormone, was in Washington this week, as was his former trainer Brian McNamee, who has claimed to have injected Mr. Clemens with those substances. Do you agree with Mr. McNamee's attorneys who are saying now this is no longer a case of he said, he said?
Well, first of all, ick. Second of all, ew.
Allegedly,
Mr. McNamee saved syringes and gauze pads with what purports to be Roger Clemens' blood and is therefore proving that he has forensic evidence that he's telling the truth and Roger Clemens is lying. And I told you this whole thing was going to get messy.
There's trouble in the Red Sox dugout as well, Charlie, where Curt Schilling was expected to reside for another year to the tune of $8 million minimum plus $5 million in incentive. Schilling's final year deal was signed in November, and in January an injury was discovered that could keep the pitcher out for the entire year. How is it that they failed to discover that injury before January?
Well, that's going to be a matter of some concern. Luckily, we have a blog, 38pitches.com, on which we can keep updated with one side of this. The Red Sox are talking about trying to get his money back. Schilling's talking about abiding by the rest and rehabilitation demands of the Red Sox and not having an operation. I will be very surprised if we see Curt Schilling pitch this year.
It was a potentially embarrassing week for two other very successful Major League pitchers. Pedro Martinez and Juan Marichal learned the hard way that the video camera never sleeps.
Yes. In the land of YouTube, if you're going to go to a cockfight, legal or not, expect that people will know about it. Apparently, they were participating in the cockfight as honorary saltadores, which is the person who puts the animal into the ring to fight with the other cock.
Albeit honorably.
Yes.
Yes.
And you do not necessarily have to die. There are cocks that can live to fight another day.
Happily, it was a good week for at least one other Hall of Fame pitcher. Nolan Ryan became president of the Texas Rangers. Does this mean he next gets to be president of the United States?
It's a very good question. It's a fast track to the White House so far. Although
you don't even have to be any good at it.
You don't have to be any good at being president of the Rangers or the United States. No, it's good to have him back in the game. I don't know how much more than a figurehead he'll be. But, he'll be around and giving interviews, and I'm certainly have some interesting things to say about his protege, Mr. Clemens.
Okay, multiple choice question coming up. The acquisition of Shaquille O'Neal means that A, Phoenix will win the NBA championship, B, Phoenix has abandoned the style of play that made them such fun to watch, or C, no crimes will be committed in Phoenix.
I have no idea. I think there should be a fourth alternative, which is D, the Lakers' acquisition of Pau Gasol from Memphis has caused everyone else in the Western Conference to panic. If Shaquille can come in and give them what he has left, every 5 or 10 minutes, they will abandon the style that's made them entertaining.
4 games after he coached his 900th win, Bob Knight abruptly resigned as the head coach of the men's basketball team at Texas Tech. Practices will be quieter in Lubbock, I suppose. Anything else going to change?
Yeah, they're still going to be a pretty mediocre team, which I suspect is why Coach Knight hung them up in the first place. And what is the Shakespearean verdict? Nothing became his career like the leaving of it. Quitting in the middle of the season while you tell your players never to quit, never to give up, and to throttle them and call them all kinds of derisive names if they happen to lack an effort. All the rules apply to everyone in the world except Bob.
And splendidly, in the speech with which he announced that he was resigning, he also took a couple of pot shots at the referees.
No, so, of course he did. But I think we should ask what the leading scorer of Texas Tech, Martin Zeno, thinks of this, because we may, in fact, find ourselves in the middle of Zeno's paradox.
On the women's side of the college game, Rutgers beat previously undefeated UConn 73-71 this week. Rutgers coach Vivian Stringer said of the game, quote, "We would either find out who we are or we would find out who we are, and we found out who we are."
Well, so I know who one
are they?
I know who one of them is, the redoubtably monikered Epiphany Prince,
yes,
who did indeed have one, getting 33 points. And, of course, I'm just glad that Coach Stringer didn't ask Don Imus who they were.
Rick Tocchet, whom you may remember as the Phoenix Coyotes assistant coach who ran a multimillion-dollar gambling ring, returned to the Coyotes bench on Thursday night. What do you have to do to get kicked out of the National Hockey League?
I'd completely forgotten about him. I thought he'd been banned for life. I didn't realize running a multi-state gambling ring got you 2 years. That's pretty remarkable.
And finally, Charlie, when I was a kid, baseball cards were serious and generally not photoshopped to illustrate something that had not, in fact, happened. This year's series of Topps cards features former New York mayor and ex-presidential candidate Rudy Giuliani jumping into a mob of Boston Red Sox players after the Red Sox won the last World Series. Can Mr. Giuliani sue?
I don't know, but I don't think it's possible for him to have a worse year than he's had right now.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
The winter biathlon is an Olympic sport combining target shooting and cross-country skiing. While relatively obscure in the United States, the biathlon is more popular than the Super Bowl in Northern Europe, and it was the most watched sport at the Lillehammer Games in 1994. But what does biathlon have to do with hundreds of New Englanders who don funny hats, strap on wooden snowshoes, and go for a walk in the woods of northern Vermont? From Jeffersonville, Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
Under a huge fly tent, traditional textiles are spread out for shoppers' perusal. Directly across from the starting line, the Vermont Trappers Association has covered a large table with hundreds of furs, safe under the steady gaze of a stuffed beaver and white weasel. The Smuggler's Notch primitive biathlon has the feel of a frontier trading post. I'm looking for Ray Salome, who told me via email that he'd be the bearded guy in the fur hat. But it seems like everyone here is wearing a fur hat and sports a scruffy beard.
I'm Ray.
Hi, nice to meet you. I'm Karen. You got a pretty day out here.
Yeah.
Not bad at all.
Well, we put an order in a year ahead of time, and generally the weather cooperates. We got a little fresh snow this morning.
Ray is in charge of this event. He sends the competitors out into the woods and stops the clock when they get back. But in the larger picture of primitive biathlon, a sport that combines muzzleloader target shooting with running in traditional wooden snowshoes, Ray claims a more significant distinction.
I guess I'm the inventor. It happened to be an Olympic year, and I must be one of about 12 people in America that watched the biathlon. And decided this was a good idea, but the snowshoes not only would be in theme with the aged weaponry, but it was also something that took a lot less skill than the typical cross-country skis they use in Olympic biathlon. You know, almost anyone can snowshoe. Maybe not well, but they can do it.
Ray's first primitive biathlon 13 years ago drew 28 participants. Today, more than 200 will cross the starting line, some more than once. Competitors are timed during their 2-mile snowshoe through the woods and stop at 4 stations along the way to shoot at 9 metal targets. For each target they hit, 5 minutes are deducted from their final time, creating the intriguing probability that the winner will be recorded as having reached the finish line before he started. Winners are determined by the best score of the 2-day competition, but competitors are allowed to re-enter and go around the course again for as many times as their aching legs and ammunition stores will allow.
Hi, Ray.
Going back out?
Yes.
Wendy Butler is dressed in a wool petticoat, which in 18th century parlance is just a fancy word for a skirt. She's also wearing wool leggings, a wool shirt, hand-spun, hand-knit mittens, a capote trimmed with an Arctic fox pelt, and a hat made from bobcat fur. Wendy is plenty warm in today's 20-degree temperatures, but this event is known for 20-below wind chills when a high-tech modern ski jacket might be a better idea.
Actually, when I started doing this, I did come out with my Swick ski hat and my fleece and my polyprop and the whole thing. But I think what we have found is that the more fun we have with our guns, the more authentic we want to make it be. So we do go for the whole outfit and have fun adding to our accessories and accoutrements. Yeah.
By we, Wendy means her entire family. Her husband and sisters compete, as do her sons. Her father won the elders division for 3 years running. And the Marilyn Grice Memorial Trophy is named after her late mother.
It sort of is fun to step back and sort of experience a little bit of history. And I think that's what's really neat about the course is you really are alone out there, which feels pretty nice. And then you come up, you get closer to a station, you might hear some shooting, but you also smell, you know, the fire burning, and that's just really, there's sort of a real attraction to that whole thing, too.
Well, it's beautiful, and it's full of fresh deer tracks, and there's fresh snow, and it's just beautiful in the woods, and it's too bad we have to try to hurry through it.
Wendy's father, Harley Grice, came out of the woods today with a broken snowshoe binding and a scorecard recording more than a few misses. He's over 70 now and finding it harder to compete against the young guys who are barely 60. But winning isn't the only thing.
These are good people. Real people, I call them. Going down in the city, excuse me. And they don't do things like this. And then you go out to Hollywood and those, that's all fake. So these are just everyday, hardworking people that are out for a little fun.
Chris Fantini!
Whoa, not ready.
Okay, fine.
Every 60 seconds, Ray Salome sends out another competitor. But even though there's a 45-minute wait to start, he often has trouble finding someone who's ready to stop chatting with friends and strap on their snowshoes. He's not worried about that, and neither is anyone else.
Even the people that come that are competitive aren't cutthroat. I mean, my first rule has always been, you got to have a good time or I'll stop doing it. And if I stop doing it, it's going to stop happening. You know, and it's gotten through to everybody. And I think it's people's nature for some reason, the people that are attracted to this.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go. Good luck.
Some sprint off at the starting line just to make it look good, but most set off in a gentle stroll, heading around the bend and into the stillness of the woods. There, the snowshoers are mostly alone, except for the occasional public radio reporter lurking next to a tree.
Hi.
Hi. Nice day, huh?
Beautiful.
Even in the heat of competition, everyone has time to exchange a few pleasantries on the trail. After a half-mile meandering walk past a frozen pond, the now warm competitors are greeted by the officials at Station 1.
Very nice. Good luck. Thank you.
As one shooter leaves the station, another snowshoes in and takes deep breaths to slow his heart rate while he laboriously loads his gun. Muzzle loading isn't easy. First, the shooter pours a pre-measured load of gunpowder into the barrel and uses a ramrod to pack down a small piece of cloth and the ammunition ball. More gunpowder is applied to the firing mechanism and the shooter takes aim, often with the help of nothing more than an old-fashioned rear sight. Then, there's nothing left to do but hope for the best. Misfires are common, and they carry the same penalty as a missed shot. Terry Van Vechten says the difficulty of muzzle loading is part of the point.
Some things are supposed to stay hard, and this is one of them. And, you know, you can just look around, and you can see that, you know, they live this stuff. You can get a history lesson from a lot of these people around here.
Terry says most of the people here would go back and live on the old frontier if they could. They'd hunt for their food and trap for their furs and sit around the campfire telling lies about the fish they almost caught. But just because some participants are serious about finding the right toque-style hat to go with their French militia outfit doesn't mean they're serious about the competition itself.
I don't ever see anybody get mad about it. Like, a guy was behind me and he fell down 3 times. And the only thing that made me mad is I didn't see it. He rammed snow down his barrel and all. He was swearing, but he never really got mad, you know. It's just part of the thing. And if he was here now, he'd laugh with us.
Let's take your time. I'm fine.
Yep, thank you.
Back at the finish line, Ray Salome jokes with a competitor who's having trouble turning in his scorecard. Maybe it's this don't hurry, don't worry attitude that's caused Primitive Biathlon to grow from just one event with 28 competitors in a small town in Vermont to something much bigger.
There are a total of 7 now around the Northeast, so there's 6 others. There's 2 others in Vermont, there's 1 in New Hampshire, 1 in Massachusetts, and 2 in New York. The neat thing is, for whatever crazy reason, when I first cooked this up, I thought that it could work, but you never know till you try it. Not many people get to design something like this from scratch, so.
And do you ever think, oh, I should have done it that way?
No, I'm happy with what I've got.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Gibbon in Jeffersonville, Vermont.
Chris Fantini, is he ready yet?
No.
Russ Miller, you're it.
If you're ready.
I'm not ready, no.
Okay, you're not ready. I'll get back to you, no problem. Keel Britton.
That's how I live. I take what you give.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to see photos of the Smuggler's Notch Primitive Biathlon or read my review of Irish Thunder, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. In our final word, primitive biathlete David Rhodes explains why he goes deer hunting in his 18th century trapper's outfit, even though it's green.
You probably could make it out of bright orange. It wouldn't be very period correct.
Yeah, and it might give the deer, most of which are unarmed, an advantage. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
That's how I
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at BreakthroughCollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.